Hey guys, as you all know, I'm always on the hunt for amazing podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of Morbidology, then I think Obscura will be right up your alley. Obscura shines a spotlight on the darker things in life. Host Justin Drowns takes a narrative approach to covering true crime stories, like mysteries, murders, missing persons, and more, all in unflinching detail. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, where you can find bonus exclusive content as well as a members-only community where you can ask Justin questions and chat with fellow fans. Simply download the Himalaya app, search Obscura, and enter promo code Obscura for your first month absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go and check out Obscura. I love the show, and I know that you will too. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Redlands is a tranquil city in San Bernardino County, California. It's known for its gracious Victorian homes, the Lincoln Shrine, acres of orange groves, and the low crime rate. While many surrounding cities are rife with gang violence and random street violence, residents of this bucolic city like to think that they inhabit an oasis. But throughout the 1990s, a wave of youth violence rocked the city and shattered their idyll. The violence culminated with the mysterious disappearance of a 14-year-old boy. For a parent or guardian, their child going missing is undoubtedly their worst nightmare, but the outcome of this case was even more horrific than anybody could have ever fathomed. Tristan Jensen was a 14-year-old boy living in Redlands with his grandmother, Betty Simon. His mother, Susan, died of cancer when he was just 8 years old, and his father, Donald, was unable to adequately care for him. His father initially placed him in a foster home before Betty stepped in and won custody of him. Tristan subsequently moved from the Lancaster area to Redlands to be with his grandmother. Living just next door was Tristan's aunt, Sally, and his two cousins, Brandon and Michael. Tristan and his cousins became inseparable.
He was immensely popular with everybody. I mean, he had this ability to, you know, just be that guy that everybody else wants to be around.
He always was making new friends. Everybody knew him. Everybody liked him. I don't think I knew one person that didn't like him. The teachers loved him. He was friendly.
While Tristan had struggled in school before the move, he thrived in his new environment. He was a student at Cope Elementary School in Redlands and earned A's and B's. Here, he was a keen member of the marching band. He was also an active member at the Church of the Latter-day Saints and a Boy Scout. He was an avid skateboarder and was a gifted musician. He could play the drums and guitar and was planning on taking piano lessons as well.
He had won the most promising music award that Cope Middle School could give. He was really good.
While he had endured a lot of hardships during his life, he was sensitive and fun to be around. He always had a smile on his face, and according to Brandon, he was a favourite among the girls. Quote, "He was just an upbeat, friendly, happy kid. We were really close, like brothers, and he was a lot of fun to be around," Michael recollected. As summer of 1998 rolled around, Tristan was looking forward to joining Redlands High School, where he had anticipated playing in the band. When he grew up, Tristan dreamed of becoming an actor. It was a warm summer morning on the 11th of August, 1998, when Tristan left his grandmother's home with his skateboard in tow. He had been wearing shorts, a t-shirt and tennis shoes, and had been carrying around $30 or $40 in his pocket. According to relatives, Tristan had been planning on heading to the banned board shop at 501 Orange Street to buy skateboard equipment with his money that he had received for his birthday 2 months earlier. Next, we will hear from his grandmother Betty and his cousin Michael.
It was close to noon when I finally had him come over and say, "You have to do your chores now." He was going to go skateboarding, and he took his skateboard and he left, but he never came back.
He ended up grabbing his skateboard and he started walking out the door, and, you know, he said later. I said, "See ya."
However, Tristan never returned home. This was completely out of character for Tristan. While some teenage boys can be unreliable and rebellious, that wasn't Tristan. He had never run away from home before and was always back inside at curfew. His grandmother, Betty, reported him missing and assembled a crew of volunteers to help search the streets for him, along with his aunt Sally.
So drove around, didn't see him, there's nothing, and just kept waiting, and then he just didn't come home at night. I had that gut-sinking feeling that something's really wrong. Just wrong.
Tristan's case was entered into the national law enforcement system, and friends and concerned locals rallied around the Jensen family. They printed several hundred missing person flyers with Tristan's face emblazoned on the front and handed them out throughout the community in the hopes that somebody would recognize him or know something about his whereabouts. The missing person flyers described Tristan as standing at 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing around 125 pounds. He had brown hair and hazel eyes and a scar on his right elbow. Summer came and went, and while all other students at Redlands High School returned for the school year, Tristan remained missing. The following month, the community was rocked by the grisly discovery of human remains stuffed in a downtown Redlands sewer system. The remains had been discovered by city workers who were investigating the complaints of a clogged sewer. Initially, it was speculated that the remains weren't real and were simply a distasteful prank.
We had these theories that they could have been placed there as a joke by medical students, or it could be a crypt was broken into somewhere and someone placed them down there.
These could have been bones that were taken from a grave site 100 years ago and someone finally just disposed of them by dumping them down the sewer system.
I thought that it might be a skeleton that was designed for instructions for possibly for a doctor or something like that. Soon discovered that there was no mechanical holes drilled into the bones, so that ruled out that theory.
The remains were sent to the coroner's office, where an examination concluded that the remains were very much real and they belonged to Tristan. They had been discovered over a 9-day period in the downtown area of Hibiscus Drive, Phlox Court and La Paloma Street.
We were lifting 300 plus manholes, and there was bone, still more bones on the side rails of the line.
We did about half a mile that we cleaned. They had to block off roads, get in there, do our thing.
Disturbingly, Tristan's hands, feet and spinal cord were never found. The officers next had the daunting task of informing Tristan's family that he wouldn't ever be coming home. His grandmother and aunt recollect the moment that they discovered Tristan was dead.
Detective Elton and Brannon came to the door. I said, "It's about Tristan, isn't it?"
I remember very clearly driving to work in the morning, early morning news on the radio, and it was the announcer. I remember exactly what he said. "I have heard of skeletons in the closet, but skeletons in the sewer? Here in Redlands? Well, that's right. Remains have been found, and they don't think it's an animal. It could be human." I just, you know, gut feeling again. Here we go. That could be Tristan. We kept saying, "Are you positive that it's him?" And there was no doubt. No doubt at all. That was him.
And that the pain is just so great. It's something you have to live with, and it hurts.
When news of the identification broke, the community rallied to support Tristan's grieving family. They organized a donation fund that would go towards Tristan's memorial service. Quote, "People in Redlands are really shook up. They have made a big circle around the family," said Cliff Young, owner of Grounds for Enjoyment on Barton Road. In fact, Cliff donated a day's proceedings, which totaled almost $4,000, to Tristan's family, who had been customers of his coffee shop. Next, we will hear from Alan Peterson of Redlands Sewer Collection Systems and Michael Ramos, San Bernardino District Attorney.
It was pretty harsh on the town, you know, old money town, you know, basically kind of like a retirement town. And these kind of things don't happen very often here. Crime here is pretty minimal.
It punched me in the stomach. I mean, I had kids that age. That could have been my son. It could have been anybody in the community.
As the community were trying to come to terms with what had happened to Tristan, police said that they still had no cause of death and were waiting for the results from the San Bernardino County Coroner's Office.
We're required to contact the coroner whenever we have a deceased person, and we don't know how the person became deceased or where they came from. The coroner's going to be contacted.
Their job is to examine the remains and see if there's any evidence which would indicate that there's trauma.
As they waited in anticipation, a memorial service for Tristan was scheduled for 10 a.m. on Saturday at the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints at 350 Wabash Avenue.
There was hundreds and hundreds of people there for him. People from all walks of life showed up to support him and, you know, remember him and support the family. And it just blew my mind.
It was a beautiful memorial, and people had many nice things to say about Tristan. He was loved.
Just days later, there was a break in the case, and police announced to the public that they had arrested somebody and charged them with the murder of Tristan. A collective chill fell over the town when it was revealed that the person who was arrested was just a 15-year-old boy himself.
We expected some predator or something, some child known predator or some homeless person or something. I said, well, his name is J.P. Remsen, and he's a classmate. He's 15 years old. And it was like the world just stopped spinning. You're like, did I hear you right? What? A punk kid did this horrific thing to my nephew? A 15-year-old kid? It was even more incredible than the crime, almost, that someone so young could do that.
Police said that on the 11th of August, Tristan had an argument with his grandmother over chores. He picked up his skateboard and headed towards the band board shop. However, en route, he bumped into one of his classmates, John J.P. Remsen, who lived in Flocks Court. J.P. invited Tristan inside, where JP then stabbed him to death before dumping his body in the sewer manhole near where he lived. Police had been made aware of JP by several of his neighbours who in the preceding weeks had noticed that JP had taken to lifting the cover off the manhole where some of Tristan's remains would be discovered and peeking inside.
We were able to come up with several witnesses that had seen JP Remsen in and out of the manhole vaults over the past several years.
While initially, the neighbors just thought it was a peculiar quirk, they became suspicious when the remains were discovered and thought it would be best to inform police. Quote, he went over there with a crowbar and just opened it up, recollected 8-year-old Michael Capitani. Furthermore, when police were searching the manhole, JP approached them and said that he had seen a suspicious dark van driving through the neighborhood around the time that Tristan vanished. According to JP, there were Hispanic men inside the car who appeared to drop something in the manhole.
This tall young man, he walked up to me and said, there was a van here the other night and was parked right next to that. I think they might have done something to the manhole.
It was a generic description and it was described to be, I believe, a 70s or 80 model van, kind of a darkish color.
He saw some people go to the manhole and I believe he said they were Hispanic and they saw him lift or put something in there and they left.
By all appearances, JP was trying to plant the seed of doubt.
The police department took a look at it and they determined there was no red van. Nobody saw anything like that.
JP was inquisitive on what we were doing on our investigation, how we were interviewing neighbors. So he was, in essence, following our footsteps during our investigation in the neighborhood and would confront neighbors about what they had spoke to the police about, and that in itself was a red flag.
JP was a special education student that had grown up in Redlands. His His father, John Remsen, was a branch manager of a Glendale Federal Bank, while his mother, Susan Remsen, worked at a local hospital. The couple had met as teenagers in Central High School in El Centro. They were both born and raised in Imperial County, where they became high school sweethearts. They were both very hardworking and religious. JP was an only child and attended special education classes at Redlands High School. His parents always tried to keep him active by encouraging him to play basketball and football, but he still spent quite a lot of time on his own. Something JP did enjoy, however, was bowling, and he travelled with his bowling league and competed. Quote, "He seemed like a normal kid and his parents were real nice. I guess everybody could have that one time in their lives when they just snap for a moment," said Jason Laguna, one of JP's bowling teammates. One neighbour, Nick Miller, said that he had watched JP grow up and had taken him under his wing to help him improve his bowling. Quote, "He's been different here lately, acting forlorn. 3 weeks ago, I saw him walking with his dad and he had a cast on his leg. I also saw him with a black eye once. I asked him what happened and he said, 'You should have seen the other guy. He's 15, but he looked like he was 17. He's a big, husky kid. We watched him grow up. This is a shock. I can't believe it,' said Nick."
He was abnormal is the only word I can think of. I mean, just a weird kid, prone to violence, loud, obnoxious. Since he was a big guy, I mean, he was a really big kid, he bullied everybody.
There was much debate as to whether JP and Tristan were friends or if they hated each other. According to police, they were acquaintances. However, Tristan's family and Jerry Sanders, a neighbour, said that the boys weren't friends. Quote, "There was bad blood between them. They knew each other, but they hated each other," said Jerry. Some students said that when they were classmates at Cope Middle School, they were friends, but then there were other students that refuted this and stated that JP hated Tristan. Quote, "Why anybody wanted to hurt him, I will never understand. He was a great kid and a friendly boy. Maybe he was too friendly," said Tristan's great-grandmother, 95-year-old Olga Lightgard. Initially, JP denied any involvement in Tristan's murder.
"Tristan never come over to your house?"
"No, sir.
Never, ever, they
never won.
Do you have anything of Tristan's at your house right now?"
"No, not at all. Nothing."
"You're telling us lies. You're trying to tell us something else to keep us from finding out other things."
"Just because I didn't like him doesn't mean I wish he was dead. Okay. You know, I feel real bad about that. I feel bad for the family. It shouldn't have happened. But I could not just in cold blood never. I couldn't kill someone."
However, after hours of questioning, JP confessed that he did kill Tristan. On the 21st of October, JP was led from the San Bernardino County Juvenile Hall to his home, where he took police through a reenactment of the crime.
Basically, they asked him if he would do a reenactment and if they could tape it.
JP told us he would, at which time we conducted a reenactment video, taking him back to the scene, showing us exactly how he committed this murder.
According to JP, on the day that Tristan disappeared, he had seen him skateboarding at the Lucky Shopping Center on Redlands Boulevard. They stopped to chat, and Tristan asked if he could go to JP's house to phone a taxi. Once inside, Tristan asked JP if he could see his knife collection, to which JP agreed.
JP told us that he was a knife collector. He had all kinds of knives in his house. The victim supposedly wanted to buy a particular knife. He wanted to buy it from him for $20, and an argument started over that.
Tristan allegedly had his eye on JP's Arkansas toothpick, which was a nickname for a 12-inch knife. Tristan offered JP $10 for the knife, but JP said no. He said that he would give it to him for $20.
"I had a knife in his hand. He said, you know, he had money. He said, you know, can I buy this?"
Things soon turned sour when Tristan called JP, quote, "a drunken bastard." An insult that was probably in reference to the fact that JP got in trouble in January of 1998 for being drunk in public. JP responded by grabbing Tristan and ordering him to apologize for the insult. But according to JP, Tristan refused to say sorry and instead insulted him a second time.
"I said, 'Do you care to rephrase what you just said?' And while I was holding him, I had the knife in my other hand. At that time, I stabbed him with the knife.
I pulled the knife out. He went limp. I stabbed him one more time.
JP then grabbed the 12-inch knife and plunged it twice into Tristan's chest, killing him. He said he stabbed Tristan with such force that the knife went right through his chest and out of his back. Following the murder, JP said that he dragged Tristan's body through the home and over a wall onto La Paloma Street, where he dropped it down a sewer manhole. JP confessed, quote, "I didn't like Tristan that much. I ran into him when I was coming home from Lucky's. A force came over me and I had no control. One thing he said set me off." Police also executed a search warrant of JP's home. The murder weapon had still not been found, and police were anticipating that they would find it in JP's home.
JP's parents seemed like a normal family. The father was a banker. The mother was a nurse for a local hospital. They just seemed like an ordinary family at the beginning.
While they did find the murder weapon, the search also led to the arrest of JP's parents, Susan and John Remsen, after police discovered a large stash of explosives. The couple were held for investigation of felony possession of hazardous explosives and chemical materials, and possession of materials to produce destructive devices. They were sent to West Valley Detention Center in Ranch Cucamonga and held in lieu of $50,000 bail each. Their bail would later be increased to $1 million for John and $500,000 for Susan. Among the chemicals found inside the home was nitroglycerin and pyrotechnic, and this led police to question whether JP had used the chemicals to help speed the decomposition of Tristan. When Tristan's remains were discovered, they were completely devoid of flesh and there was no clothing. A number of chemicals from inside the home were collected and sent off for further examination. Officials from the FBI assisted in the search of the home, as well as the San Bernardino County's bomb squad.
People were lined up on both sides of the street, just big lines of people, and news trucks, people standing on top of the news trucks trying to get pictures.
They discovered over 60 pounds of explosives, hidden inside kitchen cabinets, closets, and other areas. When the search was complete, they dug a large hole in the Remsen's front garden, surrounded it with sandbags, and detonated around 30 homemade explosives. As we ring in the new year, some of us like to make resolutions, such as managing our personal finances better or taking better care of ourselves. Enter Harry's. Harry's makes award-winning razors along with an amazing and extensive range of grooming essentials to keep you looking your best in 2020. And at $2 per cartridge, Harry's can save you money all year around. Harry's is a return to the essential, quality craftsmanship at a fair price. Now here's the good part. Harry's has a special offer for listeners of my show. New customers will get $5 off a trial set at harrys.com/morbidology. You'll get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover. So what are you waiting for? Join the millions of guys who've already switched and go to harrys.com/morbidology to claim your free offer. JP was formally charged with the murder, and it was announced that the investigators planned on prosecuting him as an adult. Quote, "To take somebody's life at that age is a horrid, tragic loss of human life," said Deputy District Attorney Mike Ramos, who would also be prosecuting the case. Ramos worked in the District Attorney's Major Crime Unit, but typically didn't handle juvenile cases. However, due to the brutal nature of the crime, he was assigned to the case. A hearing was scheduled for 2 weeks later to determine if JP could be prosecuted as an adult, and if so, his age would prevent him from receiving a death sentence. However, if convicted of first-degree murder as an adult, he could still face up to 25 years to life in prison. Furthermore, if the jury found any mitigating factor, such as torture of the commission of another felony during the murder, he could be sentenced to life in prison without parole. In a detention hearing, Detective Mark Brannan testified about JP's confession. While he spoke about the altercation and stabbing, he didn't say what happened to Tristan's body after the murder. During his testimony, JP sat quietly. He spoke only to confirm his name, age, and birthday. JP's court-appointed defense lawyer, Sam Weiss, said it was improper for his client to have been removed from juvenile hall to go back to his house where he recreated the murder scene. While Weiss claimed that this was completely out of the ordinary for police, Redlands Police Captain Tom Fitzmaurice said that it was quite common for suspects to reenact the crime and said that it was more for the suspect's benefit so that there is no misunderstanding, and he said, she said. Deputy District Attorney Mike Ramos agreed and stated that JP knew exactly what he was doing. Quote, maybe if he was 7 years old, there might be a problem, but he is 15, he knows what he did, said Ramos. During the detention hearing, JP's lawyer, Weiss, had also argued that his client was not adequately advised of his rights at the time he made the confession. But according to Detective Mark Brannan, the proper procedures were followed. Weiss also objected to the plan to charge JP as an adult. Quote, he's 15 years old. He's never been convicted of a crime. He's a tackler on the football team and he's been a student of the month before. He behaves like a 15-year-old. He shouldn't have to be in prison with adults, said Weiss. In November of the same year, Susan and John Remsen had been scheduled to appear in court for a preliminary hearing to determine whether there was enough evidence against them to warrant a trial. However, the criminal case was delayed when their attorney, Rick Beswick, put in a complaint that he had not received sufficient investigative evidence from police who had handled the crime scene. Quote, there is no way we could have a meaningful preliminary hearing for the prosecution or the defence because neither of us possess the investigative material. We've gotten very little from the Redlands PD, said Beswick. Lieutenant Patrick Beavers, who was investigating both cases, said that they were providing information as quickly as possible, but said that both cases were extremely complex and he wanted to avoid rushing into things. Quote, this is a very complex case and we have a lot of information. It is intertwined with the homicide case. It involves two courtrooms and it really takes a lot of time. Superior Court Judge Tara Riley granted the request and pushed the preliminary hearing back to the 20th of November. Shortly thereafter, Susan and John both publicly said that they believed their son was innocent. It was the first time that they had publicly spoken about the case and did so via a letter to their attorney. Quote, I am totally devastated. I cannot believe this is happening. We have always been a law-abiding, God-fearing family. We would never have believed this could happen to us, wrote John. In addition to finding their son innocent, they also said that they broke no laws by keeping weapons and explosives inside their home, but said that they didn't blame police for what they described as a misunderstanding. According to Susan and John, the weapons and explosives were simply for recreational purposes, and they had every right to keep them in their home. They described their son as friendly and caring and said that there was no way he could have committed the crime that he confessed to. Quote, I have seen him stop people from trying to hurt each other. He's a very warm, loving, gentle boy, said John. Days later, Susan and John were back in court to attend a hearing about their bail. Their defense lawyer had been attempting to lower their bond. During the hearing, a homemade videotape of their son JP was shown. In the video, JP fired a number of weapons at an abandoned house near the I-15 freeway and joked about shooting people. Some of the weapons included a semi-automatic .22 caliber rifle and an M2 carbine automatic. At one point, he joked, quote, you can blow people's lips off like blacks. I can blow 15 or 20 people clean with this. John, who is behind the camera, can be heard saying, quote, I don't want to be too conspicuous with illegal firearms, as well as telling his son, quote, you're too violent. Later in the video, John and JP can be seen detonating homemade explosives in the desert. Following the videos, Deputy District Attorney Art Harrison urged Superior Court Judge Kenneth Barr not to reduce Susan and John's bail. He said that the footage was evidence that John had no concern for public safety or that of his son. In the video, JP lit the explosives. Detective Donald Atkinson also took to the stand and testified that at the couple's home, police found several booby-trap devices, a detonation cord, and explosive powder. While Judge Kenneth Barr acknowledged that the couple did pose a safety risk to the public if bailed, he agreed to lower their bail, cutting John's down to $500,000 and Susan's down to $50,000. He also delayed the preliminary hearing to January the 22nd so that the couple's defense lawyers could review the evidence. When the bails were lowered, Susan was released on bail. In December, JP was back in court to hear whether he was going to be tried as an adult. While it wasn't made public, San Bernardino County Juvenile Court Judge John Martin said he received a probationary report prior to the hearing. Quote, apparently, he gets urges to kill, he said to the courtroom before referring to JP as a sociopath. JP's attorney, Sam Weiss, refuted this and said that JP had never been in trouble before and claimed that he had acted in self-defense. Deputy District Attorney Mike Ramos countered this statement and said that JP had been in trouble in school in the past and had attempted to cover up the killing. He contended that JP was a threat to society and if given the chance, he would kill again. In an interview with a probation officer, JP had said that he wished he beheaded Tristan and knocked his teeth out and grinded them down into dust. According to JP, if he did that, he would have gotten away with the murder. Detective Mark Brannan agreed with this statement. He told the court that he had interviewed JP 3 times, and during one interview, JP told him that he had thought about grabbing the detective's gun. He also said that during one of the interviews, JP told him that he was trying to block out memories of the murder and said that he had been having nightmares about Tristan. Quote, what I find particularly chilling about this young man is that he sits around and thinks about what he should have done and could have done to avoid getting caught, said Judge John Martin, before ordering that JP be tried as an adult. After ordering the case to go to the Superior Court, Judge John Martin dismissed JP's attorney, Sam Weiss, and ordered San Bernardino attorney David Call to represent JP during trial. As soon as the announcement was read, David Call asked the case to be moved from Redlands to San Bernardino, stating that JP wouldn't get a fair trial in the city. Judge John Martin said that that would have to be decided by a Superior Court judge. Following the decision for JP to stand trial as an adult, Tristan's family praised the judge. Quote, we're very pleased. That means JP has a chance to stay in custody a lot longer, said Tristan's aunt Sally Bell. They also said that they still couldn't come to terms with what had happened and said that Christmas was a particularly somber time as it was Tristan's favourite holiday. He should have been picking out presents and spending quality time with his family, but Tristan would never celebrate Christmas again. His grandmother, Betty, said that just recently, out of habit, she had picked up a candy cane while shopping to bring home to Tristan, but then burst into tears when she realised that Tristan wasn't going to be there. There wasn't even a grave for them to visit yet, as Tristan's remains were still being held as evidence. During JP's arraignment, his attorney entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. Not too long afterwards, JP waived his right to a preliminary hearing and instead opted to go directly to trial. While it's not completely unheard of for a defendant to skip their preliminary hearing, it is rare. In August of 1999, John and Susan Remsen reversed their not guilty plea and instead pleaded guilty to illegally keeping dangerous explosives and weapons inside their home. John pleaded guilty to felony possession of a destructive device near residences and 2 felony counts of possession of a machine gun. A 4th felony charge of possessing explosive ingredients without a valid permit was dismissed. John was sentenced to 2 years and 8 months inside state prison. Susan pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of allowing a minor to possess fireworks or explosives and was sentenced to 3 years of probation in order to pay a $100 court fine. Shortly after their sentencing, there was a hearing to determine when JP's trial could go ahead. Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos said that he and JP's defense attorney would be ready to begin the trial in early February. During the hearing, it was also decided that the trial would be held in Redlands and not San Bernardino, like JP's lawyer had hoped. The following month, however, Superior Court Judge Tara Riley decided to move the trial to San Bernardino. The trial was expected to last 6 weeks, and this was way too long a period in Redlands, which only had 2 courtrooms. On the other hand, San Bernardino had several departments which were designated for high-profile trials that were expected to last more than 3 weeks. Quote, we can't keep it in Redlands. I can't shut down this courthouse for one case, said Superior Court Judge Tara Riley. The trial of JP was slated for April of 2000 in the San Bernardino courtroom of Superior Court Judge Michael Smith, and it was being tried by a judge rather than a jury.
I mean, and then you show up into the courtroom and, you know, there he is, you know, stone's throw away from you, sitting in a chair. And you just, thoughts go through your mind. You're like, wow, really? This is the last person to see my cousin alive, and he's just sitting there.
During the opening statements, Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos said that JP had deliberately killed Tristan and then attempted to conceal the crime by stuffing Tristan's body down the sewer. Quote, "We intend to prove that this was first-degree murder," said Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos. Detective Mark Brannan took to the stand to describe how initially JP had denied killing Tristan when he was first brought in for questioning on the 20th of October. However, hours into the interview, JP changed his story. This time, he claimed that Tristan had attacked him and he fought back and stabbed him in self-defense. Later, he changed his story once more and claimed he stabbed Tristan after an argument about the price of the knife. JP's defense lawyer, David Call, challenged the alleged confession and accused Redlands police of taking advantage of JP's young age. He claimed the police had failed to properly inform JP of his legal rights before they began questioning him about Tristan's murder. According to Call, the police had misled JP into thinking that he was not a suspect in Tristan's murder and was only there to assist police in their inquiries. The confession had been videotaped, and it was anticipated that it would be played out during the trial. However, defense lawyer David Call challenged the legality of the interrogation and argued that it shouldn't be entered as evidence into trial. Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos said that the police did nothing wrong and JP made the confession willingly. Quote, "That is our biggest piece of evidence. There were no witnesses, so we only know what happened inside the home from what the defendant is telling us," said Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos. For the first time, some of the forensic evidence against JP was made public.
Finding blood in the hallway was the first thing that we did. There were drops of blood in flight, small drops of blood cast off from a bloody object. We actually found, in essence, a trail of blood leading from upstairs down the hallway to the garage.
Inside the home, investigators found blood spatter on several walls and on the door frame leading to the garage. They also found a pool of blood on the garage floor and blood and human tissue on a hacksaw and bucket. In an upstairs bedroom, they also discovered a bloody mop. The blood was identified through DNA as Tristan's, and JP's fingerprints were found on the handle of the hacksaw. In the back garden, they also found partially burned and buried clothing that belonged to Tristan. And in JP's closet, they found Tristan's shoes. With all of the blood in the house, it's unbelievable that JP's parents never noticed any of it. Quote, "We looked at both parents as being accessories to the crime, but we never found any proof. It was hard to believe, but we could never prove either parent had knowledge, even though there was a shocking amount of blood evidence inside the home," said Deputy District Attorney Mike Ramos.
Normally in a case like this, crime scene, they have this fluorescent stuff that the crime lab uses and they can pick up blood and trails. We didn't need that.
We were kind of taken aback by, oh my God, wow. After all these months, you think they would have tried to do a better job of cleaning up?
San Bernardino Sheriff Department Crime Lab forensic specialist Randolph Beasley testified that the blood spatter in the garage indicated that Tristan had most likely been dismembered. Tristan's feet, hands, and spinal cord were never found. Beasley had formed his opinion based on the angle and speed at which the blood spatter appeared to have fallen. JP's defense lawyer, David Call, countered this statement by saying that nobody knows exactly what happened to Tristan except his killer. He said that the bucket and other blood spattered items could have been moved, and therefore forming a theory of what happened based on the blood drops and location of the items could be flawed. Since Tristan's body was devoid of all flesh, there was speculation that JP had used some kind of chemical to enhance decomposition. JP's defense lawyer, however, claimed that the chemicals in the sewer had cleaned Tristan's body, but Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos said that this theory was far-fetched. Superior Court Judge Michael Smith ruled that the videotaped confession could be entered as evidence, but said that the footage of JP reenacting the crime scene wasn't allowed. After all of the testimony and evidence was presented, it was up to Superior Court Judge Michael Smith to decide JP's fate. Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos contended that the murder was first degree and premeditated. Quote, "He just didn't stab him. He then takes the knife, plunges it through the victim, pulls it out, hears him gurgling, then become limp, and what does he do? He plunges it again into him to kill him. However, JP's defense lawyer, David Call, refuted this and said that it was clearly a spontaneous act of rage and legal grounds for a manslaughter charge.
He never spoke up, never shed a tear, never looked remorseful, never looked like, you know, he wished he hadn't done it.
We all know the facts. We've all heard what happened. You know, this person is not a good person.
Superior Court Judge Michael Smith determined that the murder was intentional and deliberate, but said that it lacked the planning needed for a first-degree murder conviction. He subsequently found JP guilty of second-degree murder. Quote, "I cannot say I am convinced beyond a reasonable doubt," he said. As the verdict was read, JP sighed with relief.
I have the utmost respect for the judge in this case, and he's a very good judge, and he decided differently. He felt that the facts rose to a second degree and not a first degree murder. I respectfully disagree with that. To this day, feel it was first degree murder.
Understandably, the verdict upset Tristan's family. Outside of court, Betty asked, quote, "If that isn't premeditation, then what is?"
I mean, how can it be second degree murder? This wasn't just an accidental killing. He didn't just slip and fall on a knife, you know? This was a brutal attack.
The sentencing phase was held the following month. Betty urged Superior Court Judge Michael Smith to impose the longest sentence possible on JP, stating, quote, "I feel that Remsen should have the maximum penalty the law allows. He will always be a menace to society." JP was subsequently sentenced to 16 years to life in state prison, which was the longest possible sentence for a conviction of second-degree murder and use of a deadly weapon. With this sentence, JP must serve 16 years before being considered for parole. JP did not speak during the sentencing hearing, and his defense lawyer, David Call, apologized on his behalf. Quote, "He is very, very sorry that this thing ever happened. He wishes he could bring Mr. Jensen back, but he can't." Deputy District Attorney Michael Ramos said that he questioned whether JP would ever be truly rehabilitated. He said that JP was, quote, "a very criminally sophisticated individual," and said that he had not shown any remorse for the murder or indication that he felt remorse. Quote, "I'm afraid for the people of this community when he is released," he said. JP Remsen is currently incarcerated at Calipatria State Prison, where he receives weekly visits from his parents. In an interview with San Bernardino County Probation Officer Thomas Hammond, JP spoke about his hopes and goals once released from prison. He said he wanted to earn his high school diploma and go to school, where he would study firefighting in the hopes of having a career in the Federal Bureau of Land Management. He spoke of his desire to settle down and have a family of his own. His hopes and dreams weren't too dissimilar to those of Tristan, and while JP has a shot at a fresh new life, that's something he cruelly stole away from Tristan. In 2018, he was denied parole and isn't scheduled for another parole hearing until 2023.
There's a fear there that he might get out. I'm not afraid for me personally. I'm just afraid for everyone, any child, because he just could do it again.
In Tristan Jensen's short 14 years on Earth, he endured and conquered more adversity than the majority of adults. He was raised by a mother who tragically passed away when he was just 8 years old and was then dumped in foster care by an inadequate father. Moving to a completely new place on his own must have been daunting for such a young child, but Tristan took it all in his stride. In fact, whenever hard times fell upon Tristan, he always found something positive hidden among the negative. But on that fateful morning, on the 11th of August, 1998, Tristan faced his final battle. But sadly this time, he didn't make it out the other end. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd just like to let you all know that I published my first episode of Morbidology Plus on Patreon and Himalaya Plus. So if you want to listen to exclusive episodes, ad-free episodes, and early release episodes, head on over to Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the description. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a positive review or rating on iTunes or wherever else you listen to your podcast. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morebitology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Stay tuned at the end of this episode for a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Beyond the Rainbow. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors! I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT.
Q.
I. Okay, my specialties do not include acronyms, but they do include true crime stories. Join me as I put my spin on some crimes that you might have already heard about, such as the Matthew Shepard story and the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. I also touch upon some stories that you might not be so familiar with, such as the murder of transgender Gwen Araujo and the abusive relationship of Becky Reed and Lindsay Vox. Crimes against and by the LGBT community is nothing new, but it is a relatively new concept for a whole podcast to be dedicated to it. You can find Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT on almost all podcast apps. You can also interact with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.